Today is Tuesday, May 26th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Donald Trump attended a somber ceremony over the Memorial Day holiday weekend, but also took some time out on Twitter.
The president, while he was not taking questions, was certainly generating controversy on social media.
The U.S. marked the day as the country's coronavirus death toll nears 100,000. Also ahead, how the pandemic is impacting meals for school children in Malawi. It's all on today's International Edition. U.S. President Donald Trump paid tribute Monday to the nation's fallen soldiers on Memorial Day in a solemn wreath-laying ceremony at Arlington National Cemetery outside Washington. It's the nation's most prominent cemetery for U.S. servicemen and women. Joining us now for the latest is VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman.
Yes, in his public appearances, the president was focusing on Memorial Day, visiting the Arlington National Cemetery, along with the vice president and the first lady and several members of the president's cabinet. And that was a solemn ceremony with taps being played. The president did not speak there. He saved his prepared remarks for the second visit of the day, which was to Fort McHenry in Baltimore, which most Americans are well aware of from the War of 1812, when a man named Francis Scott Key, who was taken prisoner on a British ship in the harbor, wrote a poem called The Star-Spangled Banner, which was turned into the U.S. national anthem. There, the president did make some remarks about the pandemic, noted that tens of thousands of members of the U.S. military were deployed in what he called a war against this invisible enemy. The president, however, was quite disciplined in encounters with reporters, both on his departure from the White House and his return. He did not stop to take any questions, which is rather unusual.
Were the president, vice president, and his entourage doing any social distancing? Did they wear masks?
Well, the president did not wear a mask, and members of the cabinet, when they were at Arlington National Cemetery, they were social distancing, but they were not wearing masks during the ceremony. We did see some of them afterwards when they were walking back to their vehicles in the motorcade, and they did have masks on at that time.
The president's head of the coronavirus task force, Dr. Deborah Birx, just over the weekend made it a point to say, you know, as people go out for this holiday weekend, to make sure to wear a mask. Maybe that's why the president didn't take questions. He didn't want to have any controversy.
Well, the president, while he was not taking questions, was certainly generating controversy on social media, on Twitter, where he made remarks about a number of subjects, was very defensive about his golfing the previous day. He made some comments about his presumptive opponent in the November election, Joe Biden of the Democratic Party, and also discussed his frustration with the state of North Carolina and its Democratic governor. The president wants to be able to hold a crowded Republican National Convention later in the summer, and said that can't be done in North Carolina where it's scheduled to be held. Then perhaps they'll do it somewhere else. And on the issue of masks, one argument that the president and other top officials have made is since they are being tested daily, and when they're in close proximity to other people who are being tested daily, including members of the press pool that accompany the president, then there's really no need to wear those masks. But of course, a lot of people have said that it would be great for the president to set an example for the rest of the country by wearing a mask in public, something he's been obviously reluctant to do so far.
And you mentioned the presumptive Democratic presidential nominee, Joe Biden. He also made his first public appearance in about 2 months, and he and his wife, Jill, were apparently wearing masks.
Right. The former vice president and Dr. Biden, his wife, ventured out to a war memorial in their home state of Delaware, and former vice president saying it was good to be out. Of course, he's been characterized as basically spending the last couple of months in his basement. That has been frustrating to him and his campaign, because knows, while it's been a virtual campaign for Joe Biden, the president, using Air Force One, is able to get around to various parts of the country and appear at events that have taken on some of the characteristics of his campaign rallies.
Any indication we'll see more appearances?
There's some speculation because the president is talking about resuming rallies in the not too distant future. And of course, he is now getting out of the White House, it seems, at least once a week. And that is going to contrast him with Joe Biden sitting at home. But of course, the Democrats are going to have to get real creative on what type of events that they can put on that are going to have some degree of social distancing and not put in danger candidate Biden's health as well as those who would show up for any such event.
Well, it's definitely a stark contrast to the president, who's upset when, you know, the Republican National Convention can't be packed solid with people.
Right. Well, that's also going to be a dilemma for the Democrats as well. There's talk that perhaps the Democrats will have a number of satellite sites for their convention where you would have small groups of people socially distanced and taking other precautions. But obviously, that would not be the same, the sort of spectacles that we have witnessed every 4 years in modern American history of these very boisterous and enthusiastic party conventions that are so much part of the landscape of an election year.
White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman. The holiday is also the unofficial start of the summer vacation season in the United States, but it's been overshadowed by the ongoing coronavirus pandemic that has killed now close to 100,000 Americans. The coordinator of the White House Coronavirus Task Force has expressed concern at scenes showing large outdoor gatherings of people over the Memorial Day weekend. AP correspondent Ben Thomas reports.
We've made it clear that there's asymptomatic spread, and that means that people are spreading the virus unknowingly.
Dr. Deborah Birx tells ABC's This Week.
So you don't know who's infected, and so we really want to be clear all the time that social distancing is absolutely critical. And if you can't social distance and you're outside, you must wear a mask.
As for the possibility that a second wave of infections in the fall could prompt another round of shutdowns, Birx says the government is trying to learn how to reopen safely.
You know, we like we've actually done this before. And besides 1918 and 1919, we've not ever closed parts of America. And even then, the whole country wasn't closed.
Ben Thomas, Washington.
The White House has announced a ban on travel to the U.S. from Brazil due to the spread of coronavirus in Latin America's hardest hit country. The death toll in Brazil has surpassed 22,000. We have more on that story now from AP correspondent Julie Walker.
The ban only applies to non-U.S. citizens who have been in Brazil in the 14 days before they sought to travel to the U.S. According to Johns Hopkins, Brazil has more than 347,000 COVID cases, second behind the U.S. in the number of infections, and 22,000 deaths. President Trump has already banned travel from the United Kingdom, Europe, and China, all of which have been hard hit by the virus. I'm Julie Walker.
Syrian refugees in Turkey are reeling from the coronavirus pandemic lockdown that has put most of them out of work. These families say in Syria they hid in their homes, fearing bombs and bullets outside. Now they are locked down, fearing the virus, homelessness, and hunger. VOA's Heather Murdoch reports from Istanbul.
Eight Syrian refugees have been living in a two-room apartment, and a three-year-old girl, Zeynep, is crying out for food. The adults plucked grape leaves from a tree to make an evening meal, but it is already afternoon, and Zeynep's mother says her daughter and the other children haven't eaten all day. The rent here is cheap for Istanbul, only $30 a month, but for this family, it is still too much. Ismahan, the crying child's mother, says they haven't paid the rent in 2 months, and the landlord is threatening to kick them out. Her family normally sells tissues to drivers at traffic lights, but since the pandemic began, this kind of work is not allowed. Like most Syrian refugees in Turkey, they are doing informal work and now have no income. A patchwork of aid organizations provides some money, food, and supplies, but it's never enough. Parents say they fear their children will starve if the pandemic continues. Marwa, a mother of five, says in Syria they were locked down by the war, afraid of being killed by airstrikes if they went out. Now they are locked down by the COVID-19 pandemic, afraid of getting sick if they go out, and of starving if they do not. Turkey hosts over 3.5 million Syrian refugees, more than any other country. Public resentment towards refugees runs deep, and the government has encouraged them to leave. Refugees say as Turkey grows poorer because of the pandemic, locals become more and more hostile. This is Mohammed, Marwa's husband. In Syria, he was an opposition fighter. After fleeing to Turkey, he fixed motorcycles and painted walls as a day laborer before the pandemic put him out of work. Mohammed says he now stays up at night, fearing his children will soon be on the streets. Even after war and displacement, he adds, the hardest thing he's ever had to do is to say no when his hungry children ask for food. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Istanbul.
Elementary school children in Malawi, one of Africa's poorest countries, normally get free meals at school. But when the coronavirus pandemic forced schools to close in March, families were left with the added cost burden. The international charity Mary's Meals, which runs the feeding program in one-third of Malawi's elementary schools, has started distributing food to poor communities to help them cope. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
Mary's Meals has been feeding thousands of children in the schools for the past 18 years. The young learners receive hot porridge made from maize or soybean flour mixed with salt and sugar. The aim is to increase enrollment for children who might fail to attend classes because of hunger in their families and to meet the nutrition needs of the students. Bert Rombert is the country director for Mary's Meals in Malawi. He spoke to VOA by telephone.
We normally work in around 1,000 under 6 in primary schools in Malawi, and we have a focus on some special schools, children who are suffering from HIV/AIDS, and also disabled children. So those children received special attention, let's say in total about 940, so approximately 1 million children in Malawi are covered by this action.
The closure of schools in March because of COVID-19, the disease caused by the coronavirus, deprived students of this source of nutrition, posing a threat to their health. Rombert says this has forced the charity to find new ways of feeding the children in compliance with COVID-19 preventive measures.
We decided to make ready-made food packages that the parents could collect at the schools and take home. We wanted to limit the interactions between human beings and at the same time make sure that the individual child received their nutritious meal.
Lizdeh Kanamule says her two children are benefiting from the school feeding program. She told VOA via telephone that although the meals are meant for her children, the whole family is benefiting. She says this is helping us a lot, and because of this pandemic, things are not working. We are facing food shortages in our homes. So as a family, the foodstuffs we are receiving for our children are helping us because we are cooking porridge to cater for the whole family. Rombert says the new program is expected to run through July when the Malawian school year normally ends. He says prospects are high the initiative will resume should the schools remain closed at the start of the new school year in September. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
Botswana's strict COVID-19 border checks have riled truck drivers who say they spend days waiting to be cleared. Botswana has so far confirmed only 35 COVID-19 cases and one death, but began requiring the border testing amid rising concerns about imported infections. Mukdisi Dubey reports from Gaborone.
truck, drivers are growing frustrated with long delays at Botswana's borders due to required COVID-19 testing. The truckers say they wait for up to 5 days before being cleared to deliver goods in Botswana or transit through the country. Zambian truck driver Amon Piri complains there are no washing facilities at the border checkpost and they run out of food while waiting for results.
We are frustrated with the situation going on. We've been kept in Botswana since we crossed from Zambia for about 5 days now. No results, no results, no results. And we are all truck drivers gathered in one place, about 100 trucks. And we are being kept here with a single toilet, with a single toilet, no water, no food. We are only using the bush as a core of nature.
Piri urged Botswana authorities to speed up the testing.
They told us results are going to be out in 72 hours, but up to now, nothing has come out. We are appealing to the authorities to take action now.
South African truck driver Malusi Dlamini says the delays have led to tensions across the border in South Africa. He says some South African truckers are threatening to block trucks entering from Botswana if the situation is not resolved.
It's a frustrating situation. We hope that it will be addressed soon before tensions boil over. There are long queues of up to 10 kilometers of trucks waiting to be cleared.
Botswana truck drivers are also subjected to COVID-19 tests when they re-enter the country. Landlocked, Botswana imports about two-thirds of its goods from South Africa. Botswana's COVID-19 task force team head, Dr. Giring Masupu, acknowledged the challenges faced by truck drivers. But he says remedial action cannot be taken overnight. Steps will be taken to improve the lives of drivers while awaiting their results, says Masupu, and their welfare should be taken seriously as they provide an essential service. Botswana introduced COVID-19 testing for truck drivers after confirming several imported cases of the coronavirus from truckers in the past week. Mqondisi Dube for VOA News, Gaborone.
Here are some of the other stories we are following at VOA. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Monday that Israel will not miss a historic opportunity to extend its sovereignty to parts of the West Bank, calling the move one of his new government's top tasks. Palestinians consider it an illegal annexation of occupied land they want for a future state. Last week, they declared an end to security cooperation with Israel and its ally, the United States, in protest of the plan. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson's closest aide refused to resign on Monday despite calls to quit from lawmakers, Church of England bishops, police officers, and scientists over his 250-mile trip from London to northern England while Britons were being told to stay at home to fight the virus. They say it damaged citizens' trust in public health messaging. But the aide says he did nothing wrong by making the drive to access childcare. The World Health Organization said Monday that countries where coronavirus infections are declining could still face an immediate second peak if they let up too soon on measures to suppress the outbreak. The WHO emergencies head said the world is still in the middle of the first wave of the outbreak and noted that while cases are declining in many countries, they are still increasing in Central and South America, South Asia, and Africa. Stay with VOA for all the latest U.S. and world news. Police said they arrested more than 180 people Sunday when authorities fired tear gas and used a water cannon to disperse anti-government protesters as unrest returned to the Chinese-ruled city after months of relative calm. The demonstration comes amid concerns over the fate of the One Country, Two Systems formula that has governed Hong Kong since the former British colony's return to Chinese rule in 1997. Journalist Ria Mogul is in Hong Kong and was out observing the protests. International Edition's Steve Miller spoke with her via WhatsApp to learn why some feel One Country, Two Systems may be coming to an end.
No one was expecting it really when China announced yesterday that they would impose these new national laws. And make no mistake about it, by doing so, Beijing has sent a very clear message to Hong Kong, and that is that they are tightening their grip on the special administrative region. So these laws, when passed, would give the Chinese Communist Party more control over Hong Kong. Today, actually, is when the annual gathering of the National People's Congress kicks off in Beijing, and they are likely to approve this law, which would curb sedition, secession, foreign interference here in Hong Kong. And this law would actually be implemented through a rarely used method that would bypass Hong Kong's legislature.
Yeah, can you explain how that mechanism works? Because Hong Kong is governed under the basic law, the mini constitution that was put into effect after the handoff.
That's right. So in fact, a little bit of background. In 2003, about 500,000 people took to the streets to protest against the implementation of Article 23 of the basic law. And as you said, the basic law is this is Hong Kong's de facto constitution. Now, Article 23 would have allowed Hong Kong to enact laws on its own to prohibit any act of secession, sedition, and subversion against China. And after the peaceful demonstrations, the legislation was subsequently shelved. And now there's a little loophole that is in the basic law, and it's called Annex 3. And Beijing would be using this to completely bypass Hong Kong's legislature to implement these new national laws 17 years after 500,000 people peacefully demonstrated their frustration.
Now, this is coming after several months of protests, sometimes violent, last year. What do we know about why Beijing is implementing this now? And then, you know, what's been the reaction, you know, to this move in Hong Kong?
As expected, Steve, there is absolute outrage here in Hong Kong. The Hong Kong people see this move as undermining one country, two systems, which is what was put into place when the British left Hong Kong in 1997. And, you know, Hong Kong was officially supposed to become part of China in 2047. And many activists are saying that this will be the end of Hong Kong as we know it. And I, you know, the reason that Beijing has come down so hard is, of course, as you mentioned, last year's anti-government movement, what started as a series of peaceful protests against the now shelved extradition bill, soon, you know, morphed into these often violent displays of dissent against Beijing's encroachment into Hong Kong and the alleged police brutality and what people saw as an erosion of freedoms, of their rights.
What are you hearing about people possibly getting together to voice their concerns about this implementation of Article 23?
Yeah, in fact, you know, last night as well, the anger was rife. Just hours after the new law was announced, people took to Telegram, which is the social media app that's used by protesters, and messages were flying about to gather in various districts in defiance of China's announcement. And people did gather in, you know, districts that are closer to the border of China, and police, riot police were gathered in these districts as well. And there have been calls for more demonstrations to take place tonight and over the weekend as well. There were calls for some protests to emerge during the day, but not much has transpired. But we'll just have to wait and see whether anything will happen this weekend and whether anything will take place tonight as well.
As the coronavirus continues to grip many parts of Africa, including Kenya, residents in Nairobi's Eastleigh, a predominantly Somali neighborhood, are celebrating the end of Ramadan in lockdown after the government extended movement in and around the area for another 2 weeks. Some families say they have never experienced an Islamic celebration like this one. Mohammed Youssef tells us some families say they have never experienced an Islamic celebration like this one.
Mohammed Osman is an Eastleigh resident and one of tens of thousands of Muslims celebrating Eid al-Fitr, the end of Ramadan. He says this is a different Eid for him and his family.
Gurigi baan fadhina suuqi lama adi karo oo alaab inta badan wax badan lama soo gadan karo
We are at home, we cannot go to the market, and you cannot purchase a lot of items because everywhere you go, there are security officers around, Osman says. You cannot go out. For us, business people, we are not allowed to go out. This Eid is very different from previous Eid celebrations. We prayed, but there is no celebration, family gatherings we used to have before, he says. The father of three says he is finding it hard to explain to his children the need to stay at home. I tried to keep them in the house. In previous Eid celebration, I used to take them for outing, Osman says. Now I buy them a few items to keep them busy at home, but they are not happy with what we are doing at all. They are too young to understand the challenges we are going through, he says. Another resident of Isli, Abdishakur Garad, opened his clothing business on the day of celebrations. Garad says, I have never seen an Eid celebration like this one, where people are not allowed to celebrate together. He says, people are afraid of each other. They don't touch each other, nor shaking hands, nor visiting homes. In my entire life, I've not encountered an Eid like this, Garad says. Kenyan authorities closed off the area May 6th after 29 new cases of the coronavirus were found there in a single day. Authorities are allowing medics and food to enter the area. To limit the spread of the virus, Kenya has banned gatherings and ordered communities to follow health precautions and wear masks in public. Mohamed Shakul, a religious leader, says people need to follow the precautions set by health officials.
Many people are dying, and they thought that we really need to take this message very seriously if we need to be saved from this disease. Even from the Islamic point of view, Islamic perspective, there are so many narrations from the Prophet, peace be upon him, Muhammad, that taught us that these are practices that are done when the plague took place many years ago.
Last week, Kenyan authorities extended the restriction of movement in the area for another 2 weeks. Kenya's government spokesman, Cyrus Oguna, said the restriction is to keep the community safe.
The strategy to be able to deal with such situations is to contain or to cordon movement in and out of such area so that nobody would go in and get infection from there, unknowingly so, and nobody would get out and distribute that infection or spread infection to other areas.
The restriction on Isli is expected to end June 6th. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
And finally, Queen guitarist Brian May says he recently had three stents put in after experiencing what he describes on an Instagram video as a small heart attack. The 72-year-old said it was shocking because he thought he was completely healthy. The month started with May and Roger Taylor, the remaining members of Queen, teaming up with singer Adam Lambert to release a new version of the band's We Are the Champions to raise money for frontline healthcare workers battling COVID-19. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Wunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thank you so much for listening. Please take care and be well.
What's going on, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi coming to you from the Voice of America studios here in Washington, D.C. Join us each week on Upfront as we discuss a range of topics. The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
Eliminate the mentality that girls cannot do what boys can do.
You basically need to go to school. There's just no way you're going to get all the skills that people want from you or they expect from you if you're not at school.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
And AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at UpfrontAfrica.